So these are some comments on this week's reading, which is Edmund Burke and then Friedrich Hayek. This is something from the period of the French Revolution. So Burke's text is 1790, and then something that is roughly contemporary and contemporary with Milton Friedman from last time. So we again have, well, not roughly contemporary, but 1960s. We again have these kind of classical sources, and then we have an updating of those sources. Now, this is strange because technically what we're looking at with Burke is what most people think of as the foundation, one of the classical, maybe the most classical statement of modern conservatism. But Hayek actually wants to claim Burke as a liberal. And Hayek, I think probably the easiest thing for us is to call him a libertarian. He accepts that term. He just doesn't think that it's got a very nice ring to it. He prefers to be called a Whig. But in our circumstance, that has next to no meaning. And libertarian, we recognize immediately. The positions that he's advancing are libertarian. And as a result, you get all kinds of interesting confluences in these two characters together. Because on the one hand, Burke is recognized as a conservative. But then you have Hayek who wants to say, no, Burke is really more like a libertarian like me. But then you also have Hayek saying, look, some of the things that I'm saying may sound conservative, and in fact, empirically speaking, he thinks that libertarians and conservatives, especially in the United States, have all kinds of overlap just pragmatically. Their principles don't necessarily overlap, but the things that they practically support do. But he nevertheless wants to call himself a liberal. So this then implies that a whole bunch of the things that real liberals in the line of Smith, Friedman, and Hayek support are also things that conservatives support. So this is very strange, given that in our circumstance we have been educated to understand that the two ends of the acceptable political spectrum are the liberals and the conservatives. And then the unacceptable spectrum, the things that we generally are made to understand or told to understand are too extreme, is that if you go further past the liberals to the left, you end up in socialism. And if you go further past the conservatives to the right, you end up in fascism. This whole picture is really complicated by what's showing up here. So I think that Hayek really does have an opposition to conservatism as a political philosophy, although he also says that political philosophy is very far removed from practice, and he seems to be okay with that. His critique of conservatism is very simple. It's that conservatives want to hold on to existing conditions, not to challenge them, to revere them. And yet, it doesn't really matter to them what those conditions are. And I think this is a very observant thing. You can have all kinds of different conservatives who hold on to radically different positions, ways of life, and political realities, just because they exist in different historical and spatial circumstances. So you can have, the Burke-style conservatives. I mean, there's still an Edmund Burke Institute in the United States, right? So it's not unfamiliar to refer to Burke. You can have that kind of conservative who ends up being weirdly close to classical liberalism. But then you can also have, Christian conservatives. That's not what Burke is, although he might have been sympathetic somewhat, who are advocating for the sustaining and even the propagation of principles of life derived from the Bible or their sect's interpretation of the Bible. But that you could also have conservative versus, progressive factions within a Native American community. And this is going to be very different because to be conservative in that context would mean to hold on to old patterns of life. Whereas, I mean, there really is this sort of division, practically speaking, in the politics of Native groups, where you might have one group of elders who wants to govern and live and live according to old patterns of life, whereas you'll have maybe younger group of leaders who are more integrated with surrounding power structures and think that, you know, the movement towards casinos and the leasing of land to ranchers and oil companies is the most pragmatic and reasonable thing to do. So, you know, the conservative, the native conservative and the Christian conservative and the pro-capitalist conservative and the Islamic conservative are totally different conservatives. This is Hayek's critique, that the conservatives don't actually have, in the principles of conservatism, don't have clear principles of their own. Conservatism is just a stance of preserving whatever happens to be there. Okay, that's legitimate enough. And I also think that you can see, if we really look at this, that as you know, liberal or left as you might consider yourself, there clearly are plenty of cases where being conservative, holding on to things, or at least being skeptical about change is perfectly reasonable. I think that's an important thing for people who lean to the left, considering themselves liberal or progressive or socialist or anarchist, to recognize. Not that that necessarily means that they have a whole lot in common politically or pragmatically with people who call themselves conservatives, but as a principle, the idea that all change is good, which is something that Hayek sort of leans towards, seems to me to be very problematic, especially given that the liberal capitalist affirming progressivism, this idea in progress, which is so typical of the whole Western tradition. This is a logic, you know, Vine Deloria talks about this idea that we're always moving towards something greater and greater and greater. This has been a part of European expansion and colonialism and economic exploitation and environmental degradation and the claims that have been made that we're moving towards something better. Today, as I can barely breathe while making these recordings because of the smoke in the air, doesn't seem very convincing to me. I don't see that, you know, all progress is necessarily good. So as a principle, you know, like being a little skeptical about change might be reasonable too. Anyway, I also think that you can see in this picture how in the American context, though we have been taught that conservatives and liberals are very distinct things, and they exist at really different ends of the spectrum, such that if we have a party that is generally understood as the conservative party, the Republicans, and then another party that is generally understood as the liberal party, and that's the Democrats, actually they agree on more than they disagree on. And even with respect to the institutions that they want to affirm or the patterns of life or the organization of society that they approve, they actually agree on more than they disagree on. And then if we were to shift this over to a, you know, an honest evaluation of the way that the Republican and Democratic parties operate, who's good they operate for, and who they objectively get funded by, you might arrive at a kind of cynical position or a kind of pushy position, which is one that I affirm, which is that, yeah, okay, right now we're in this landscape where, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats are clearly fighting, and yet I would still affirm that they are, in the end, just different wings of the same party. I'll try and support that a little bit as we go along here. So let's talk about Burke, first of all. Burke is writing in 1790. He's in England. He's a member of Parliament. He's coming from Ireland, although he's not particularly concerned with the domination of Ireland by England. And he's writing in this context in pissed off opposition to the French Revolution. I think some of the ways in which he argues against the French Revolution are easily critiqued, and especially the way that he puts it is easy to critique. But I would say in his behalf, even before I start laying out these positions, that this is 1790, so this is before the Terror. You know, he's making these sort of grand, sweeping declarations about the madness, the instability, the violence, the murderousness of this revolution because he sees an aristocratic class with which he identifies, an aristocratic and property-owning class with which he identifies. He's seeing it be swept away. And the guillotine has already appeared. But the intensive usage of that guillotine and the killing of tens of thousands, 30, 40,000 people, hadn't really got going, and yet he could see it coming. So although as I list off the positions that he takes, I think you'll see that there are some things that are really problematic. And this is largely because we've been raised under an ideology that affirms a whole lot of the ideas that become dominant through the American, but especially the French Revolution. So what seems normal to us, or a lot of us, is going to be to the progressive side of what Burke has to say. Nevertheless, he does have a point about the direction in which the French Revolution was going. Okay, so let's start at the beginning. What does it mean to be a conservative? And why is Burke generally understood as a really good example of what conservatism means even today? Well, very simply, to be a conservative is to hold that there are things that are worth conserving, and that politically we should keep in mind these things that have been worked for, that required a lot of labor, that guarantee a certain amount of stability and security, and even what some people think, at least, is a good way of life. We ought to value what already exists, value the order that already exists, and specifically the set of social relations, the institutions, and the sets of values and manners which are generally distributed, which are distributed by churches and schools and media. The conservative perspective is all of these things have value. They took a long time to construct. Even if they have their weaknesses, they seem to be holding us in some kind of pattern which is livable. And there's a skepticism about change. If we just start shifting everything all the time on the basis of whims, or on the basis, and here is a real place where conservatives and liberals or libertarians of Hayek's persuasion do indeed conflict, we shouldn't just allow change to happen every time there's a technological development. Of course, American conservatives are not consistent on this point, because they and the liberals actually affirm capitalism, and capitalism implies and rests upon a perpetual technological change in the division of labor and so on. I'll come back to that. But conservatism simply means saying that conserving things is really important politically, and that while, you know, as Burke puts it, it might be necessary now and again to modify a part. When you modify a part, you should only do that on the basis of antiquity. You should be affirming and valuing the values and principles that already existed, even when you have to change things. Change should be very considered, it should be very limited, and it should ultimately happen in order to preserve the overall structure. By the way, here's a weird way in which liberals, who are totally into reform but actually don't want revolution, I mean, no matter what liberals say, or no matter how much the right tells you that all Democrats are, you know, crazy revolutionaries, liberals don't want to change the property system. They don't want to change the capitalist system. At best, even progressives are a form of reformist, right? So this is a weird place where the conservatives state the principle, but even though the liberals are supposedly different from them, they actually agree with it too. Okay, so think about this question of what is to be conserved. It is strange and interesting that there does exist in the United States a very right-leaning conservative think tank and, you know, institution called the Edmund Burke Society, and that a whole lot of American conservatives would happily identify themselves with Edmund Burke. What is strange about this, for one thing, is that the context in which Burke is writing is still, largely speaking, an aristocracy. Now, we are post-1688. We are past the Glorious Revolution, which elevated landowners and included in that elevation big property holders who didn't necessarily have blue blood, who didn't have family names, or at least not the old family names. But the ruling group that Burke thinks needs to stay in a position of rule still involves a monarchy, right? You know, the very monarchy that the American colonies rebelled against is still in place in England. It is balanced out by a parliament, but of course that parliament is, and this is an important thing to think about in the United States too. I think, you know, we think that our Congress and our Senate represent the people, but they really represent a few people more than anybody else, with exceptions here and there. But those exceptions, you know, AOC, have to be few, and their voices and their power extremely limited. Anyway, in the English circumstance, the power block that Burke thinks needs to be conserved includes a king and a queen and an aristocracy and a whole bunch of families that have names going all the way back into, well, at least the Middle Ages. You know, he acts like this has gone on forever. And like all ideologues, like all ideologies, he emphasizes nature all the time. You know, like, this is what is natural. Nature declares that by nature, we revere people based on who they are descended from, right? He acts like these families came from eternity. In fact, they had been established for, well, long enough, right? 300-400 years. And some of them not that long. But the block that he affirms should stay in power is people who are in positions of government, people who are in positions of property ownership, and this is still including a monarchy and an aristocracy. So Burke, the conservative, is pro-monarchy and pro-aristocracy, whereas the Edmund Burke Institute is neither pro-monarchy nor pro-aristocracy, but radically pro-capital. They're both still pro-government. They're both still the maintenance of whatever government is going on. They're both definitely and fundamentally still proponents of property and big property. I sort of wish, I guess last time around, I included a different segment from Burke, which included a couple of little details, mostly the same text, but with a couple of different details that weren't in this passage that I gave you. Two of those things are, you know, there's a passage where he talks about property and the importance that property can't be equally distributed and still operate as property. You need big property. And the function of big property is effectively to change any kind of radical or fast, to prevent any kind of radical or fast change to the system. Property has to be big property, and big property implies control by a few over the many. And he affirms that. The other one is where he talks about the incapacity of everyday working people to govern. Somebody who has been cleaning manure out of stables their entire lives does not have the capacity, does not have the education or the habit or the intellectual abilities, Burke thinks, to engage in government. And yet this is what he sees happening in revolutionary France. Anyway, so we know what conservatism means in general. There is this weird fact, which Hayek is very sensitive to, which is that conservatism affirms existing structures of government and property and mannerisms and gender relations and divisions of labor and institutions and patterns of life. But conservatisms in different places, therefore, will affirm different things. This is Hayek's critique again. Conservatism does not have its own principles. It doesn't say how we ought to live. It doesn't say how government ought to run or what constitutes a good government versus a bad government, whether there ought to be limits on property or not, or what form of property, who ought to have the property. Rather, it is an attitude of affirmation towards existing systems, whatever those systems may be. Okay, so then what are the contrasts between the England that Burke affirms and the revolutionary France that he challenges? Well, it's basically that in England we have a long-lived order of hierarchy, which Burke thinks of as stability, as nature, as what is desirable. And of course, this is way easier to do if you're affiliated with the propertied and governing classes. If you are a relatively rich man involved in government itself, it's easy to say that this country, which is governed by a few rich people, is correct. It's easy for him. And he says a whole bunch of condescending things towards the rest of us. You know, yes, he says, I believe in rights. And he's responding to what he thinks is way too extreme happening in France. Yes, I believe in rights, but these rights have to be modest. They have to be limited. You have the right to live by a law, but you shouldn't have the right to make it. Not everybody has that right, only people who have inherited it. He believes in inheritance. Everything's about inheritance. Property is inherited, you know. So the prince inherits half of the country, but the son of a shoemaker, if lucky, is going to inherit a shoe shop. And the son of a pauper is going to inherit nothing but hunger. And these inheritances, he thinks, are natural because the system is natural. But there's not a reason that this system, as opposed to another one, is called natural, except that it has been there for an awful long time. That's good enough for Burke. He's like, let's not overthink this stuff. Like, let's rely on tradition. You have the right to live by law, but not to make it. You have the right to live under a system of justice, but not to determine what that system is. Maybe you have a right to work and eat, but only according to the job and the food supplies that are available to you given your class. There's this right of inheritance, which I just mentioned, which is a fundamentally unequal right. And you even have the right to be controlled. This is a good that is given you by the government, because if you were not governed, perhaps your passions would go crazy, and so that would be an injustice to you. But all the things that are being said by the revolutionaries over in France, I have the right to life, liberty, property, equality, self-government, to take part in government, to be a part of determining what are going to be the laws that govern me, these things are unacceptable. This is too crazy. Not everybody has the capacity, or should have the capacity, thinks Burke, to judge for themselves. They don't even have the capacity, they don't have the right to defend themselves against the government, which I suppose is the view of conservatives today too. You know, I actually have had students in the past week write to me that, who are they talking about? That a whole bunch of the black dudes who have been shot by police recently, well, they were responsible for it too, right? Oh yeah, it was George Floyd. George Floyd ought not to have used a counterfeit bill. So because he did use a counterfeit bill, he is equally to blame, along with the cop that put his knee on his neck until he died. You know, like, whoa, that's heavy, right? But like, that idea is, you know, like, George Floyd doesn't just have a right to protect himself against law enforcement. You know, he has the right to live under law enforcement, in a really kind of nauseating literal sense in this case, right? But he doesn't have the right to defend himself against law enforcement. So it's a much more radical view that would say, no, we gotta take that stuff back, and we have a right to oppose the police. Burke and the conservatives don't think that at all. And this whole idea that the French have, that the king and the queen are just people, and they're people who are living really well on the basis of the exploitation of a whole lot of people who are living very poorly, that idea Burke really hates, right? So I'll conclude by saying, you know, he affirms prejudices. And he's being very careful here, actually. And he doesn't live in the time where we do, where we, like, you know, knee-jerk know that the word prejudice means something bad, right? Literally, prejudice just means prejudgment, something that you have already thought and affirmed and believed before a present circumstance and upon which you rely. In this sense, almost all of our knowledge is prejudicial, right? And everyone is prejudiced, meaning that we have certain judgments which predate any particular encounter. Well, Burke wants to push this further and say, look, there are all kinds of prejudices that we don't even know why we have them, but they are venerable nonetheless. We shouldn't overestimate human reason. We shouldn't overestimate our capacity to choose and guide ourselves, because actually we're very frail beings. There's a kind of Christian vibe in the back of that, right? We're fallen beings, apt to make mistakes and to judge in the wrong way. And therefore, we should, according to Burke, depend upon the judgments of people who came before us. We shouldn't just throw those judgments away, those ideas. And of course, this does lead back into a discussion about prejudice as we understand it. You know, the preconceived ideas about the working class, about different racial groups, about different genders. I do think that Burke is defending those kinds of prejudices to some extent. He's saying there's some kind of wisdom in there. There's something true in there, which, of course, we being the inheritors of a lot of the ideology of the French Revolution, but also of the civil rights movement, are probably pretty hesitant to affirm. But, you know, a lot of people who still think Burke is good at some level or other are saying, like, look, yeah, the way that people think, the way that white people think in this country, it might sound bad to some folks, but there's good reasons for it, right? The conservative view here is at odds with social change and social critique. And that's part of its nature. Okay, so let me move on to Hayek now. A lot of the critique that I gave of Burke was coming from Hayek, or a portion of it, this emphasis that conservative positions have simply to do with affirming whatever system is there, and therefore they're going to be really different in Iran than they are than in France. Maybe let me pause for a second and say again why it is that I think that libertarians and liberals in this classic sense overlap in a lot of ways with conservatives in our context. And this is something that Hayek, you know, acknowledges multiple times. It's that the conservative view, by definition, is to affirm the institutions that exist. But the institutions that exist in the United States are largely capitalist institutions, maybe entirely capitalist institutions. And therefore, the conservatives, because they just accept whatever is there, and the liberals or libertarians, because they affirm the free market, according to Smith and Friedman and Hayek, they end up affirming the same institutions. This is the reason that I think that conservatives and liberals are generally on the same side, you know, as opposed to socialists and communists and anarchists, who are revolutionaries. Liberals and conservatives are not revolutionaries. They affirm a system which is already a capitalist system, therefore a hierarchical system, therefore a property-based system and a profit-driven system, therefore a competitive system, therefore an atomistic system. Both the conservatives and the liberals affirm this system. Okay, so here are the things that Hayek has to say. He says, okay, yes, he doesn't like the word, but from our context, it makes more sense to call him, he's a libertarian. And then he'll define this. What does it mean to be a libertarian or a liberal in this like classic liberalism, neoliberalism sense? It means fundamentally to have, and I think there's a bunch of naturalizing language here. Like, he doesn't use the word by nature very much like Burke does, but he does use the word spontaneously grown a whole bunch. And I think that's the same thing as occurring by nature, right? Occurring not by force. He says a libertarian or a liberal is someone who affirms those institutions which are spontaneously grown, and further, which have a faith in so-called spontaneous growth. But this is, it's not just any spontaneous growth. I mean, we're not talking about like mold, we're definitely not talking about the commune, and we're not talking about like, you know, the people who spontaneously come out of their houses and challenge the police in the streets. That's not the spontaneity that we're talking about at all. The alleged spontaneity really refers to capitalist institutions, which are supposedly spontaneously grown. But I would ask you to, you know, really reflect on that. You know, is it really true that these systems and practices, which, you know, employ us at a certain wage while making a small class extremely wealthy, that they simply emerge by nature and involve no coercion and compulsion? Or might we see that property itself is a form of coercion and compulsion? Anyway, the libertarian position, the liberal position here, is all about the free market. And this is how he will distinguish libertarians from, or liberals from, conservatives, is that the libertarians and liberals have a faith that the free market will, it's going to cause change, right? It clearly causes change. we have all kinds of, we have an ever ongoing increase in resource extraction. We have new technologies all the time. And with new technologies, we also have new divisions of labor, new ways of life. We are far more precarious than people were 50 years ago. The form of our employment is totally different. People used to stay in one job for a long time. Now we work a whole bunch of jobs and we bounce around between jobs. The functioning of the market, the development of capitalist economy, necessarily implies changes to the social fabric, to the way that we live, to the way that we use our land, to the way that we relate with one another. The difference between the conservative and the liberal on this point, supposedly, is that the liberal embraces all that change. And definitely this is a part of, like, you know, what we would recognize as liberal discourse, right? Embracing change, embracing progress. Whereas the conservatives would be thought of as refusing change, disliking change, wanting to hold on to old patterns and old ways. Now, there's a Marxist point hidden in here, which is that even though, you know, we have conservatives who affirm capitalism, capitalism is itself, by its very nature, revolutionary, meaning that it changes conditions all the time. The whole history, the past 500 years of history that now is heating up the globe in every which way, physically and politically, in terms of migration and war, that is capitalism. Capitalism carried out that change. Capitalism is at the root of the American Revolution and the French Revolution and arguably the Mexican Revolution, or the early Mexican independence anyway. These all have to do with the rise of the bourgeoisie. The only principle which capitalism always preserves, and this is the fundamental function of the state in a capitalist understanding, is property. And this, again, is the point where the liberals are conservative. But the fact that the conservatives affirm capitalism means that the conservatives are actually liberal. There are certain changes. There are certain processes of change, ongoing and ceaseless change, which, insofar as one is a conservative capitalist, one necessarily affirms. It's kind of a messy thing here. And I would point out, you know, like, I think there's all kinds of reason to distrust these market forces. The liberal position is that we have faith, says Hayek, that we will be able to adapt, that good adaptation will occur as new knowledge, new scientific knowledge, new technological breakthroughs, new modes of currency, new modes of exchange and speculation, new modes of communication. As all of these things, these newnesses appear, the liberal libertarian perspective is that we have faith that good adaptation will ensue from that. Well, I think a conservative question there is like, well, why do you have that faith? Not all change is good, yo. You know, like, this is important to recognize. Maybe we should be conservative, but not necessarily. I don't think that our conservatives are generally conservative in this way. They don't question capitalism. They don't really question technological development. Rather, they question the consequences and correlates of these things, the social relations. You know, if you're going to change social relations from the binary couple in the nuclear family to include same-sex relationships and extended families and even people who challenge the gender binary, the conservatives are going to object. But the overall society, with its changes in communication and technology and work and modes of life, which at least is related to these challenges to the traditional family, those things they don't question. There's an inconsistency there. Last comments. The claim is that conservatives differ, this is Hayek's claim, differ from liberals in a couple of ways. One, that they are comfortable imposing especially their moral values on other people, whereas liberals supposedly are not. And you can evaluate for yourself the degree to which you think that is true. I mean, I'm picturing people challenging women going into abortion clinics, right? They certainly feel okay trying to impose their so-called value judgments upon other people. This is Hayek's claim about conservatives. He wishes they wouldn't do that. And he thinks that the conservatives' love of law and order and of the police corresponds to this willingness to impose family values, let's say, so-called family values, upon other people. Whereas liberals are supposed to be distinct in both of these respects. So we already heard from Friedman very clearly that the liberal view is that values and ethics are private matters and ought to be kept private. You can't bring out your values and impose them on other people. The best you can do is protest, but you can't ever use any kind of force. And yet, on the other hand, I think that a capitalist system, these allegedly spontaneous institutions, which Hayek and Friedman both affirm, amount to the imposition of forms of life, and control over the media apparatus by capitalist means amounts to the imposition of values on everybody. It's just that the liberals aren't recognizing that they affirm that. They're claiming, they're using words like freedom and spontaneity, but what they mean by freedom and spontaneity is profit and the growth of profit. Those values, I think, are imposed, so I would challenge Hayek on that. And then the other opponent of libertarianism or liberalism, according to him, is socialism. And I think we have a very familiar, very reductive, overly simplistic, sometimes very falsified vision of what socialism means on this view. Socialism imposes an equality that is unnatural upon people. It is willing to identify values, the idea that, you know, everybody ought to work according to their capacity and everybody ought to receive according to their need, which, according to this liberal view, is just a personal view. The socialists are willing to impose that upon society by organizing society in such a fashion that national resources are used for a national population, for example. He does think that conservatives and socialists, and he really means like Stalinists and maybe Chinese communism, have similarities. They tend to be nationalist. They tend to be militaristic. They tend to be authoritarian. Okay, I don't think that socialism implies authoritarianism at all, but it is clearly true that in the Cold War situation here and in the real empirical case of the Soviet Union, it was. And in the Chinese case, it is. I'll leave it there, I suppose. I think it's worth recognizing that the views that Hayek is expressing about these different camps, and especially about socialism, are dominant for us now. And so we should ask, I suppose, the degree to which he really knows what he's talking about. But that will require us to go ahead and look at what socialism is in principle later.